All right, everybody. This is your host, Jonathan Metz, and I'm here with a very special segment. We are talking with Tommy Tallarico about the upcoming Video Games Live concert in Los Angeles that's coming up right after E3. We don't do interviews very often, so I hope this goes well. Tommy, thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're excited to have you here on this special episode of Radio Free Nintendo. And first off, let me explain to the listeners who might not be familiar with you. I think that's going to be a small percentage, but let me just give some of your accomplishments here. Tommy has, is it fair to say, like three branches of your career, if I can split it up this way. You've been involved with the sound and music creation for many, many dozens and dozens of games, including classics like Earthworm Jim, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, recent stuff like Line Rider, and even Metroid Prime, which we'll get to later. certainly you have a well-known legacy of video game music credits to your name.
Don't forget Color of Dinosaur on the NES too. That's a very important part of my legacy. Yes.
I wasn't going to bring that one up, but I'm glad you did.
Oh, you got to. You kidding me?
Yeah. Of course, Tommy is also the star of TV shows such as Electric Playground, Reviews on the Run, and then I think the equivalent of that in Canada is Judgment Day, right?
Actually, it was called Judgment Day here on that crappy station G4.
Right.
But in Canada, it's called Reviews on the Run.
Okay, got it. I got it flip-flop there. Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries.
But of course, he's been on TV for many years now, mostly doing game reviews, right? I know that's what I've seen you doing.
No, actually, Electric Playground started back in 94, 95 as kind of a news magazine for video games. So we were kind of the first, me and Vic Lucas, we were kind of the first guys to say, you know what, let's put game developers, and me being a game developer myself, but saying, hey, let's put game developers and interview them, and let's find out how we make the game, how people make the games, and this and that. So it wasn't, you know, like a gamer competition kind of thing or whatever, but it was the first real, you know, news magazine about video games, and that show is now a daily show. 15 years later, where they're still doing it.
And are you on the daily version? I don't have cable,
I haven't been able to do the TV show stuff for like the last 3 years since Video Games Live, you know, really took off. That became my, you know, my focus.
Right.
And I still do music for certain games. In fact, I got a big Wii game coming up.
Oh, you want to tease us a little?
It's called Flip's Twisted World.
Okay.
And for the Wii, we did all the music and sound effects for that. And then I also, the game I did before that was Sonic and the Black Knight. Mm-hmm. I did a couple songs. Sega of Japan called me up, and I was on tour at the time, and you know, but when Sega Japan calls up you know, an American composer, that's a pretty rare thing. So they said, hey, we want you to do music, and I was good friends with the music director on the project, and Jun Sanao from Crush 40, and they said, hey, we want you to do some songs. I'm like, oh, man, I could probably only do like, you know, three or four songs. I'm like, hey, we'll take whatever you can give us. So that was fun. I kind of did a rock and roll orchestral thing, which was pretty much what I do every night on the road. So it was right up my alley.
So Video Games Live, of course, is the third big part of your career that I was going to bring up. You started this back in 2002, right? You co-founded it.
Yeah.
And obviously, you're kind of the front man for it, but what is your involvement day-to-day in the production? I mean, this thing's on kind of a perpetual global tour, this huge orchestral stage production with a giant screen, laser lights, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. How involved are you in, you know, the arrangements, playing the music on stage, organizing it, promoting it, etc.?
Yeah, well, I'm the creator of the show. I co-founded it with Jack Wall, another video game composer. And I create the segments, arrange the music. I edit all the videos in the show, every frame of animation and video. Then I'll sit down with a lighting designer, and I do the lights. And I produce the show. I do marketing, the PR, the sales. I run the website. I host the show. I play guitar in the show. what else do I do? Gosh, everything. I 20 hours a day. I mean, we have 10 people in our crew, and everyone does, you know, certain things and things like that. But yeah, it's you know, become a huge part of my life. So
I can see why you're not on TV anymore.
No, exactly.
At least not until the PBS broadcast. I mean, that's a huge announcement this year, is that Video Games Live is going to be on PBS this summer.
I mean, it really is. I mean, the reason I started Video Games Live, you know, I've been a video game composer for over 20 years, but the reason I started Video Games Live is I wanted to prove to the world how culturally significant and artistic video games have become. And that's why I created the show the way I did. I didn't want it to be a traditional symphonic show. I mean, there's other game concerts out there that are like that, and I think that's great, you know, but that's not what we wanted to be. We wanted to be a show. We wanted to be an entertainment, you know, a whole entertainment deal, you know. So, and the reason that's so important, you know, Video Games Live, it's all the greatest video game music of all time played by a full symphony and choir. But what makes it really unique and special is that everything is completely synchronized to massive video screens and rock and roll lighting and special effects and stage show production and interactive elements with the crowd. I kind of like to describe Video Games Live as having all the power and emotion of a symphony orchestra, but combined with the energy and excitement of a rock concert, mixed together with all the cutting-edge visuals and technology and interactivity and fun that video games provide. So the whole idea was that you don't have to know a darn thing at all about video games to be able to come to our show and be able to follow along with the video screen or just watch this kind of, you know, Vegas spectacle kind of deal, you know, kind of unfolding in front of your eyes, whether you've ever played a video game or not. And the people who are the non-gamers who come to our show, which make up about 40% of our audience, wow, they come away with a huge understanding and new appreciation for the game industry, you know. And I challenge our boy Roger Ebert, I challenge him to come to one of our shows and tell me that video games aren't art.
Yeah. Well, you guys are definitely taking, you know,
that fat ass.
You guys are definitely showcasing all these amazing artistic elements of it. So he can't argue with that part.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the spectacle, I haven't personally been to one of these shows yet. I've really wanted to, I just haven't been able to, man. Maybe in LA I can. I live in Colorado now, but
We're coming to Denver. We've actually played Colorado before. We played Loveland.
Oh wow!
Which
okay.
is about 45 minutes outside of Denver, right?
Yeah.
Well, Loveland was a good show. We played a big arena show out there, but yeah, we're coming to Denver. I want to play Red Rock someday, but
that would be incredible.
That would be pretty sweet with lasers bouncing off the thing. And
oh man,
yeah.
I just, from what I've seen of the production, I get the sense that it's almost like, you know, like a Pink Floyd show. I mean, it's just like there's,
it is.
It's
yeah,
such
it's
a
like
huge
Pink,
production.
It's, yeah, it's kind of like Pink Floyd meets Beethoven meets Star Wars. I don't know.
Right, right. Awesome. What does it take to get a production like this on tour? I mean, one thing I'm really curious about is, do you have a full symphony orchestra that you're taking around the world, or are you mostly using local talent and sort of teaching them the music and teaching them the show and syncing it all up on site with kind of, you know, in situ resources?
Yeah, I know. It's all local orchestras. Like right now, I'm calling you from I'm in Dallas, Texas. I just flew in today, and we have two shows this weekend with the Dallas Symphony. So yeah, so we you know, we'll have all day set up tomorrow. We start loading at like 7:30 in the morning, you know, with all the lighting and the trussing and setting up all the microphones and all the video screens. We have three massive video screens and all the click tracks for the orchestra, and we gotta get that set up by noon. And and you know, we have like about, you know, 12-15 stage hands that help us do that, and we have 10 people in our crew, and then by noon we're doing the choir rehearsal for about an hour just with the choir. And then by 1 o'clock, the orchestra gets on stage. We have a 3-hour rehearsal.
Wow.
From about, you know, 1 to 4. And then, you know, we, you know, kind of tighten everything up and doors open at 6 and the show's at 7:30.
Wow. All in one day.
Yeah. So all in one day.
I get the I assume maybe I shouldn't go this far, but I would assume that most of the people in the orchestras are sight reading this music, and they're not familiar with it like they are the famous Mozart and Beethoven and Bach.
Absolutely. So, oh, you're 100% correct. Yeah, I mean, they know what Beethoven sounds like. Maybe Sonic the Hedgehog, not so much.
Right.
So
and when you're working with these musicians all over the world, a lot of times maybe you only work with them once or twice. I mean, you must have worked with thousands of musicians. What is the general kind of reaction you get from all these professional musicians to playing video game music? Do they seem kind of leery of it? Do they seem like they undergo that transformation through the experience of where they come to respect video game music where maybe they didn't before they did the concert?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, a lot of the symphonies, a lot of the orchestras are getting younger now. So, you can see, we walk on stage for the first time, there'll be a 30-year-old cello player. And he's like, yeah, fucking Halo tonight. He's all psyched, But there's a certain percentage. And I would say that it's a smaller percentage. It really depends on the orchestra. But, there's probably a small percentage that are, shall we say, apprehensive of when they first walk in, they might sit down at their chair and they're paging through the music and they say, Chrono Trigger, World of Warcraft, what is this? This isn't Stravinsky, but then they play the music. And then when they play the music for the first time, they're all looking around at each other and they're kind of nodding their heads going, oh, wow, okay. this is legitimate music.
Right.
Final Fantasy sounds just as good as any classical piece of music, but then the show happens and there's, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 young people screaming at the top of their lungs like it's the second coming of the Beatles or Elvis Presley, then that's when you have something, because then by the intermission, I'll get people coming up to me, saying, they'll say, I've been playing the oboe for 40 years and I have never had a crowd like this. Thank you so much. When are you guys coming back? We're rock stars, And so what starts out as apprehension earlier in the day transforms into adoration by the end of the night, saying, thank you so much for bringing us a younger audience and for them to be so excited about this stuff, so that's the fun part for us.
That's awesome. Now, in terms of your personal involvement in the performance, are you up there, you're playing electric guitar most of the time? Are you playing for the entire show, or you kind of sit in on certain numbers?
Yeah, I take up the guitar towards the end of the show for like the last four or five pieces, because we want to take the show to the next level, one of the important things, I've created over 60 segments for Video Games Live, over the last 5 years. But we could only play about 18 of them a night. So it's when I put together a set list, I've never played the same show twice. And so when I put together a set list, it's always about dynamics. It's about you never want to play three big giant numbers in a row. You don't want to play Warcraft, then Myst, then One Winged Angel next to each other. So you want to, I mix in some classics, so I'll mix in some old school stuff. I'll mix in some emotional stuff, some slower stuff, and then you do a big piece. And then we have fun interactive bits with where we bring people up on stage and they'll play a video game while the orchestra plays along and changes the music in real time. We'll have a Guitar Hero competition where, the Guitar Hero winner comes up on stage and they play guitar the game while I'm playing real guitar and the orchestra's playing.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
then we'll have a big rock number. And then I put in some of the classics like the Mega Mans and the Castlevanias and the Zeldas and the Tetris. And, it's really, that's the fun part. But so for the dynamic of the show, when we get towards the end and we really want to kind of take it up one more notch, that's when I'll come out with a guitar and electric guitar and start playing along with the orchestra.
And before that point, are you mostly kind of directing from backstage, or are you the conductor for most of the show? What is
yeah,
your...
no, Yeah, no, I host the whole show, so so I'll come out and set up each piece or whatever, and you know, kind of the MC, if you will.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, and there's a lot of, I mean, there's a huge video screen, right? So, I mean, there's usually what game footage or trailers or CG cutscenes playing during the music as well that goes along with that piece.
Yeah, yeah, I do all the video editing for the whole show, and yeah, so it, yeah, like if I do if we're doing Mario, for example, I'll put together like a huge Mario video montage, which shows the whole history of Mario, you know, and I'll go back and forth in between games, or something like what we do with our Sonic the Hedgehog segment, where I'll do a chronological history of Sonic from, you know, starting out in 91, 92 with the original Genesis game and going all the way up through game Sonic 4, which hasn't even come out yet, you know, but you'll see this the footage there. So, yeah, and sometimes we'll actually play a segment of a game or a like Assassin's Creed 2, for example. We play a whole scene of the game with the music underneath, but we also have the sound effects and voiceover playing along with it as well. So, yeah, so it's all different. Sometimes we'll just play cinematics, like maybe for some of our Warcraft pieces, the Warcraft things are, you know, the cinematics are so beautiful, that, you know, we put together things like that, and, other segments, we just show gameplay. And so, yeah, it's all different.
Cool. Now I have kind of a philosophical question about game music for you, because you're, I can't think of a better expert on game music really than you or Koji Kondo, probably, and I don't speak his language. So I've got you here.
Koji doesn't speak much English, no, that's for sure. Actually, he understands it really good. He's a good buddy of mine, and he understands it pretty good, but he's a little shy when he's speaking it.
He won't spit it back to you. And you've played with him during the video games live shows, right?
Have yeah, a couple times. Yeah. Yeah, we in fact Koji Kondo, the very first time he ever performed live in his home country of Japan, was during Video Games Live, believe it or not.
That's awesome.
Crazy. Yeah. The audience went absolutely crazy. And he played this really awesome, it was from, it was Mario Brothers, it was Super Mario World, and stuff from Galaxy as well. And he played this really kind of rhythm and blues, R&B kind of jazzy blues version of Mario on solo piano. It was epic. You can actually go on YouTube and just, you know, do a search for Koji Kondo and Video Games Live.
I will. I will. Yeah. So my philosophical question is, you know, you're, as you're describing all of this other stuff that's going on while the music plays during your shows, it strikes me that video game music is something that most people don't listen to by itself outside of the game. And that goes for me as well, personally. And it's not because I think game music is inferior, but I feel like game music is usually tailored to the specific experience of playing the game. I mean, it's not composed in a vacuum, right? So it's usually made for that game specifically. It's meant to accentuate. It's the same as a movie soundtrack, a score for a movie. It's made to accentuate what's going on the screen or maybe what's happening in the player's mind while they interact with it. So do you feel like game music that is tailored for an experience in that way can also work on its own if you just pop it in your car and you're driving along and you lay back on your bed and put on your iPod?
Yeah, I mean, first, I would respectfully disagree with your first statement of that, you know, game music is only made, you know, is the kind of tailor-made for the game. I've actually, in the 300 video games I've worked on, I've actually never taken that approach.
Really?
Like, you know, I've always taken the approach of, you know what, it's got to be a great piece of music. I want it to be a great piece of music. Like, if you play a, you know, like some of my earlier stuff, like Earthworm Jim, for example, there's a banjo tune playing for when he's rocketing through asteroids, you know, like that. It was never like, you know, we were just having fun. Let me just make cool music and we'll put it in places that not necessarily might not work, but it'll be funny because it's a funny game, you know? So let's do a polka cartoon for this sci-fi level, or it's an underwater thing, so let's do a slap bass, you know. But so my approach to video game music has always been in the way it differs. Now, I would agree with that statement if you were talking about film or television music, because film and TV, you know, they're linear media, so the composer is absolutely trapped within that form of linear media. And film and television, they're stories, right? And right. So there's lots of dialogue. So the music for those for those mediums is considered background music or incidental music, because people are mostly talking to tell a story. Whereas with video game music, the big difference is, I like to call what we do foreground music. The big difference with us is that the music is actually driving the action. It's driving the interactivity. So for example, in a film, most of the time, a film composer, 80% of his music is being talked over. Right. Mm-hmm. But he might get the big title screen at the beginning, and he might get two or three big chase scenes, and that's always his favorite part, right? And but even the great John Williams, for example, has to sit down with the not so great anymore George Lucas, and they have to sit down, and George Lucas will say, okay, John, at 2 minutes and 36 seconds, the music has to do this because Darth Vader just walked through the door, and then at 3 minutes and 24 seconds, the music has to do this because the Death Star blows up. So he, you know, when he writes a piece of music, it is for that, you know, for that piece of linear medium. Now let's take a video game. A designer will come up to me and he'll say, okay, here's a situation. I have 100 guys on horseback with swords all coming to kick your ass. Write me a 3-minute piece of music. You know, so now I don't have any barriers or restrictions. I can just imagine this battle going on in my mind and the music that would possibly potentially go along with it. And also, as you're going along with it, maybe you kill off a certain number of people and there's only 50 guys left. And then there's only 10 guys left. And then 2 guys left. And then 1 and then 0. So I might write that same song, but I might orchestrate it and arrange it in 4 or 5 and record it in 4 or 5 different ways, depending on the action that's going on screen or in my mind. And then I'll have the programmer say, okay, look, play this mix when there's 100 people, but when there's only 2 people left, dip into this mix and crossfade into this one. And it's a lot less instruments, and maybe there's not as much percussion, and maybe I've dropped out the choir and this and that, and the strings, the violins are playing 8th notes now instead of 16th notes or 32nds. So, you know, so there's a lot of different, you know, methods and interactivity that help to drive the adventure. And so, you know, that's why I've always said that I think if Beethoven were alive today, he'd be a video game composer. There's no doubt in my mind. He wouldn't be a film composer. He wouldn't want people talking over his music.
Yeah.
So, you know. And
yeah, that's a great point.
Comparing film music to game music, another big point to consider is that, you know, let's take the last Raiders of the Lost Ark film. Last indie film. Unfortunately, let's pretend. I know we all try to pretend it didn't exist, but let's take that film for example. You know, you listen to it. You go to the film. You listen to about, you know, 90 minutes of John Williams' great music, 80% of which is being talked to. Mm-hmm. And then maybe 6 months later, you break down, even though you hated it, but you had to buy the DVD, right? Or the Blu-ray. And so you watch it at home again. And again, you get that same 90 minutes of music, 80% of which is being talked over. So in the course of 1 year, you've listened to about 3 hours of John Williams' music, 80% of which was being talked over. Okay. Now let's compare that to, oh, I don't know, let's say World of Warcraft, where the music is out front, not being talked over, and people are playing that game 20, 30, 40 hours a week, and the music is in their face, and they're playing it for years and years. I mean, consider that. No time ever in the history of music has more music been played more often than in video games. I mean, that would be like taking your Beatles White Album or your Pink Floyd The Wall or, you know, Led Zeppelin 4 and putting it on repeat for 40 hours.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe people did that in the 60s when they were tripping on LSD. But now you don't get that so much. But and so that's, you know, that's really important. That's a really important thing that's happening in game music. And I'll give you one last comparison that I think really puts the cherry on the top, which is, you know, you might be familiar with a site called ocremix.org.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Of course, right? And so there, ocremix.org is a site where there are thousands of people all around the world uploading tens of thousands of video game remixes in all sorts of different styles, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I want you to show me where the film score version of that is online. Tell you what, it doesn't exist. So you tell me how important video game music has become in our world where, you know, and there's video games cover bands, right? In every state, you'll see a video game cover band somewhere somebody's playing, right?
Right.
Show me the movie score cover band. Where are they? They don't exist. So, you know, when people say to me, oh, do you think video game music will someday be as important as film scores? I'm like, what are you talking about? We surpassed them about 5 years ago.
Great point, man. I know we're running out of time here. Before you go, I have to get you to talk about your involvement in Metroid Prime, because this is this is almost like an urban legend kind of situation. Because I remember when the game was in development, I read at IGN that you were involved somehow along with some other musicians, some American musicians, and then the game comes out, you're not in the credits, but that doesn't mean you didn't work on it. So,
I'll tell you the whole story. I'll clear up all the confusion and the internet rumors and awesome. This and that. You know, because you know, there's a crazy, and because this is a Nintendo, Nintendo site, I'd also like to clear up that, you know, a lot of people thought that I hated Nintendo because I would give certain Nintendo games low scores on the show. Now, the reality is I gave everything low scores.
Yes, that was my impression.
it didn't matter if you were Nintendo, Sony, or Xbox. I did not play favorites. I gave a lot of great scores, and I gave a lot of crappy scores. You know, mostly lower scores. I was more of a realist. I'm not one of these... You know, and I never consider myself a reviewer at all. I'm not a reviewer. I was just some guy who was talking to his other friend about video games, just like every gamer does with their friends. They talk video games. We just happen to have a camera on us, you know. So I never really consider myself a game reviewer. I mean, that would be presumptuous of me to even think that. I'm not. I don't want to be that. I was never that. And so, but. You know, so a lot of people would think, oh, he hates Nintendo because he gave this a low score, he gave that a low score. And it's like, no, I just hold Nintendo to a higher standard, mm-hmm.
I think my colleagues and I at the website and the podcast can sympathize with your position there.
Yeah. And
we're pretty critical of Nintendo, too, but it's because we love.
Exactly. I mean, you know, anyone who's been to a video games live show and have seen Mario and Zelda and Metroid and the love that I show and that the show shows to Nintendo. I mean, that's enough said there. So that let's get that rumor out of the way first. I'm not a Nintendo basher, a Nintendo hater. I love them and grew up with them. I'm wearing Mario underpants right now. I mean, it's crazy.
Ooh, TMI. But,
yeah. No, I'm kidding. It's actually Zelda. But so I've been friends with Miyamoto for many, many years, and we would always say, you know, boy, someday we got to work together. Wouldn't that be fun? And so it was at E3, and gosh, I forget what year it was, but and I was also good friends with. The guy who ran the company that was developing it in Texas,
mm-hmm.
Retro Studios, yeah.
Are you talking about Jeff Spangenberg?
Yeah.
Okay,
but Jeff, there's a big controversy around Jeff too. Oh my God,
were you in that hot tub?
I was not in the hot tub. I was invited to many parties. I never went to any, but I heard great stories and from folks, and they'd have these great yacht parties and everything. But anyway, that's a whole other podcast. So it was me and Jeff and Miyamoto, and they were kind of looking at each other, and they were saying, "Gee, should we tell them?" Because it hadn't been announced yet; it was a huge secret. Mm-hmm. And there's three of us, and they said, and Miyamoto kind of whispers something in Jeff's ear, and Jeff says, "Oh, really? Oh my gosh! Okay, cool." And so Miyamoto says, and Jeff says, "Hey, you know, we would like you to work on the game that we're doing right now." I said, "Really? Well, what's that?" And they said, "Well, you can't tell anyone this and that, but we're working on Metroid." I'm like, "Get the hell out of here. Serious?" I'm like, "Count me in, dial me up." And we all had great smiles. We took many pictures together. And so Retro at the time was working on about four or five different games. They were working on like an RPG. They were working on like massive games too, not like small things. They were all like, you know, massive stuff here. And they, you know, Nintendo had, I think, bought them at that point. And and so when they first hired me as a contractor, and they said, "Look, we want you to do all the I did not do any of the music. People think I did the music to the game because I think that came out over the internet at one point. But no, they had the original composer of Metroid do the music. I was hired to do all of the sound design, because sound design was going to play a very important role in Metroid, because the music is a lot of times, you know, it's very kind of atmospheric and you know, great stuff. And so the sound effects and the weapon sounds and the visor sounds and, you know, the atmospheric ambiance and all that stuff was going to play an important role. So they said, you know, so they hired me, and I was the first guy to work on the sound. So I did all the original like demos and some of the trailers, the initial trailers that you saw. I'd, you know, worked on a lot of that stuff. And then I started doing all the weapons, you know, I started to do sets of weapons and visor sounds and a lot of the stuff that, you know, that made it into the final version of the game. And then what happened is they had hired me for like, I think I worked on that game for about 2.5 years. Wow. And it was just me at the time who worked on it. And then after the contract ended, they decided that Metroid was going to be so big that they were going to shut down all the other games that Retro was working on.
Right.
So they said, "You know what? We're going to cancel everything else, and we're going to put everybody in this company onto Metroid." And so they had an internal audio department. And the reason the internal audio department wasn't working on Metroid and why they wanted to hire me was, one, I was friends with Miyamoto and Jeff, and they wanted me to, you know, Miyamoto said he always wanted to work with me. But the other reason was the main reason was they were working on all of the other games that now got canceled. So when all the games got canceled, the audio department was 100% open and clear to work on it. And they had like, I think, three or four guys working at the time. So, and my contract was up, so, you know, it didn't make sense for me to continue going. And like I said, I had done a lot of weapon sounds and visor sounds and some of the enemy things and this and that. And so that was it. And so okay, cool. So then what happened is Metroid got delayed probably, I think, 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come out till about 3 years after I had stopped working on it. So within those 3 years, it probably saw about 3 or 4 different producers on the project. Mm-hmm. So it went from one producer to the next one, and that guy would leave, and then somebody would come in. Now, again, so by the time the game had come out, you know, and it's not like I was calling these guys every month or whatever, you know, you move on to other things. You never, you know, once you're done, right, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so when the game had come out, the producer who was working on that game, who was working on the finalized of the game, you know, they're the ones who kind of do the credits for the game. And he had no idea that 5 years ago I worked on this game, you know. Mm-hmm. And so my name was never in the credits. And then which is fine. I mean, it happens all the time in the video game industry. But what was interesting was then they were getting ready to do Metroid Prime. I think they were doing the second one, yeah. And so then another producer, they wanted to upgrade all of the sound effects. So they went back and they said, okay, they went back to the audio department and they tried to get all of the higher quality versions of everything. And they found a directory that was called Tommy Tallarico, and they're like, what the hell's this? And it was all of the, you know, the weapon, a lot of the weapon sounds, a lot of the visor sounds. And so the producer then contacted me and he says, look, I got a question for you. Did you work on Metroid Prime? I said, yeah, for almost 3 years. And they said, wow, hey, do you have all these sounds? because we need them in high quality for the next couple versions of the game. And I said, yeah. You know, and a lot of people, you know, said, oh, he got fired from the project because he gave Nintendo low scores or something crazy, you know, internet stupid stuff. But the reality was is that, you know, I just, you know, that I had worked on it and they just didn't put my credits in. And so I said, yeah. I said, but could you do me a favor? He said, sure. What? I said, could you write me a letter saying that and put my name in the credit or something, or write me a letter saying that, hey, thank you for doing the sounds for Metroid Prime. So, you know, in case it ever comes up, at least I have some kind of proof. And he kind of laughed and everything. He said, yeah, sure. But I'll tell you a really quick Miyamoto story, and because I know there's a lot of Nintendo fans out there listening, obviously. A lot of people will say, you know, why is he so different? Why is he so great and this and that? Here's a little insight. When I was working on Metroid Prime, when we first started, normally in video games, sound effects are considered post-production. So, for example, when when I'm working with Cliffy B on the Unreal series, for example, when we work on Unreal Tournament 2, he would send me an animation of a chain gun or something, and he said, here's a chain gun. And you'd see the animation, and you'd match the sound to that animation, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, video game sound effects are done, sound design. Well, Miyamoto comes up to me, and he goes, Tommy, he goes, here's what I want you to do. I would like you to just create awesome weapon sounds. I don't want there to be any limits. I want your imagination to just go crazy. I want you to just create me really cool sound effects of weapons. He goes, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take those sounds back to my artists, and I'm going to have them listen to your sounds, and they will create the weapons around the audio.
Wow.
Whoa. You know? And so we created like a lot of like that, like the pulse rifle, you know, like I'd create this and then the artist kind of heard that and said, oh, you know what? What I'll do is when they fire I'll have it charge up. And when it fires, that kind of sounds to me like the screen is like warbling or something, or like the thing. And so that weapon and that effect actually came from the sound effect, and it kind of was, you know, kind of went from there. So that's why Miyamoto's so great. He doesn't think like normal designers. He thinks outside the box. He turns everything on its head. And the other great thing about Miyamoto, I asked him once, I said, let me ask you a question. When you know, because I've worked on almost 300 games in my career, and, you know, half of which were just awful piles of trash. And I've seen, and you know, and to say that you've worked on half games that are good, that's actually saying something. That's
a pretty good track record.
It's impressive if you have 10 good games on your list, you know? You know, the hits don't come around too often, but and so I know what makes a crappy game. I can write a book about that. Right. But what makes a great game, what makes The Secret, and that's the stuff you got to bottle. And so I asked him once, I said, let me ask you a question, because a lot of the crappy games are crappy for two reasons. One, they run out of budget, and two, they're just not passionate about games, or they're just not passionate about what they're doing, you know? So I asked him, and Miyamoto's passionate about everything he works on, so he's got that one down.
Mm-hmm.
But I asked him, I said, how long does it take you? Once the game is finished, how long does it take you to, like, test a game? Because normally, in a game, they usually put in for the budget, and all the games are always late, and so at the end of the project, they'll put like 6 to 8 weeks in or something for game testing, right? And as they're finishing the game. And a lot of times when it ends up being late, that gets cut down. And that's why games are buggy, because they run out of money and time. So Miyamoto tells me, he goes, what I do is I have a date for the game when it's finished. And then when we complete the game, when we all sit around the table and say, okay, is this game finished? And everybody says, yes, it's finished. Then I add 6 months to it.
Wow.
And I add 6 months of testing and tweaking. And that's why when you play a Mario game, for example, a platform Mario game, and the jumps are just so perfect, and it's just the right height, or it's just the right length, or it's just the right speed. That's why. And if you ask any game developer out there, hey, when you finished your game, if you could work on it for 6 more months, how great would it be then? You know, and that's what it's about. And that's why you'll notice all the great ones, the Will Wrights, the Miyamotos, you know, the Warren Spectors, the Bungies, the Blizzards, they all have one thing in common, Kojima-san. They all have one thing in common. They will not put out a game. Will not put out a Half-Life, another one. They will not put out a game until it's completely 100% finished. Mm-hmm. They don't care what the budget is. They don't care what the time is. You know, Bungie would rather be 2 years late with a game than have it come out. And the same thing with Metroid. When I worked on Metroid Prime, the thing was, you know, 3 years late. You know, but the reality is it was worth the wait. And I think any gamer would tell you, gamers love to complain a lot about, oh, it's freaking late, and Zelda was supposed to be here last year, and it's not here. And then when that game comes out, and when it's a great game, all that disappears.
Right. You forget about the delays.
You forget about the delays. And they would never admit it, but they would welcome them. If they only knew that extra year made the difference, you know, then they don't care, you know? And so you look, and it's really simple, isn't it? I mean, all the companies I just mentioned and all the games I just mentioned, the designers I just mentioned, it's simple. That none of them will release the game until they don't have time schedules.
And they're all rich and famous.
And they're all, that's what makes a triple-A game.
Yep.
A triple-A game is, it's got to, you have to have passion, and you can't be under a budget.
Right. Thanks for the great story, man. We're going to have to wrap it up, but I really appreciate you taking the time, and it's been a pretty fascinating interview, I have to say. Thanks so much. So the next performance, the next big one will be right after E3, like the day after E3, right, in Los Angeles.
It's the last day of E3. Well, I mean, we got two shows in Dallas this week with the Dallas Symphony, and the next week, on Thursday, June 17th, the final day of E3, we're the closing ceremony, and we have so many special guests. It's unbelievable. We have guest composers. We have the composer of Metal Gear Solid is going to be playing his song Snake Eater from MGS3 on saxophone with the symphony. A very good friend of mine, Akira-san, you know, the game director and composer of the Silent Hill series, he'll be playing Laura's theme from Silent Hill 2 with the orchestra on guitar. The composer of God of War will be conducting his piece. We're doing the world premiere of Africa. We're doing the world premiere of Uncharted 2 music with the composers up there conducting. Jasper Kidd from Assassin's Creed 2 will be there. We're going to be doing that. And then we're going to do a special amazing thing. I don't want to give away what song it is, but it's just an amazing piece of music that everybody knows and loves. And I'm going to keep that for the very end. And I'm going to have all the composers from around the world come out on stage, all playing instruments and all playing together with the symphony to play this thing.
Wow.
It's going to be awesome.
Excellent. And when can we see you on the public broadcast station?
Is that right?
PBS. When can we see you on PBS?
Yep, that's going to happen nationwide starting July 31st. It's going to run all week long, and I would please recommend to folks that, you know, just to make sure, just it's real simple. Just go to your local PBS station's website and just email them and say, "Please bring Video Games Live." And there's a great trailer on YouTube. If you do a search for Video Games Live plus PBS. We released it 5 days ago. It has like over 150,000 views already. And we're doing a CD and a DVD and a Blu-ray to go along with it. And the CD and DVD actually and Blu-ray, it's the very first time that Mario, Mega Man, Zelda, Sonic, Castlevania, all these things have been released outside of Japan. You can't go on iTunes right now and buy Mario and Zelda and Mega Man.
Right.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
Well, July 31st, it will. And so it's the very first time. So we're really honored that all of these publishers are working with us they really get it. You know, they're starting to understand, you know, the effect that Video Games Live is having on the world. You know, we're playing 60 shows a year now. And for anyone out there, just check out videogameslive.com and go to our tour dates page. We're probably coming someplace close to you. And if we're not, email us and we will get the show there.
Excellent. All right. Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate everything you're doing, and I wish you continued success.
Awesome. Thank you so much for helping spread the word.
Hopefully I'll see you at E3.
Heck yeah.
All right. Thanks, Tommy. Tommy Tallarico. Great. Had a great time, man. Thanks.
Thank you.